My uncle in London had managed to get me to get a job for me as a trainee waterproof cutter in a clothing factory in Glasgow. After my uncle emigrated from Germany, he had to study for one more year in Great Britain to make a British medical certificate, which he did in the Glasgow University. And through the year he lived in Glasgow, he had made a number of Jewish friends here, and one of them was prepared to take me into his factory as a trainee waterproof cutter. He made raincoats and things like that. And this is how I managed to get a permit to come to the UK, because if you had no work permit, if you had no work place, you couldn't get an immigration permit. So it was all a bit difficult. But right, I arrived in London. Can't remember anymore which airport it was. I think it was Croydon Airport. Our relatives collected me, and I went to them, and then within a few days I had to go to the Woburn House, which at that time was a registration place for all Jewish refugees arriving in Great Britain. And I told them I was going to live in Glasgow, and they gave me the address of the Glasgow office where one could ask for assistance and for help and financial help and so on. But I had made up my mind I wouldn't take a penny, neither did I take a penny. I asked for nothing, and I came to Glasgow, and they had got me Dick, that got Dick's for me with a Mrs. No, what was he called? With a Jewish family who lived in Allison Street. Well, my salary, which I was going to get as a trainee waterproof cutter, was going to be 30 shillings a week. I paid 28 and sixpence a week for my dicks, which left me with 1 shilling and sixpence for the rest of the week to live on. Of course, with my dicks, I had my food. People were extremely nice. They were very helpful to me, very nice landlady, very considerate. But at 1 and sixpence, you couldn't do a hell of a lot. So I walked to my place of work every day and walked back. It was about 35 minutes walk. It was in Shawlands. The firm was called Universal Covers, and the owner was a Mr. Joe Levy, where I worked. So one day, that lady where I lived said, "Martin, why do you walk there every day? Do you not have the money for the tram?" I said, "Oh yes, I would have the money for the tram, but I like walking." Because she said, "If you didn't have the money for the tram, I would charge you a shilling less a week than you have money for the fare." I said, no, you 28 and 6. But I like walking. So, as I say, I arrived there, and I stayed with them for a couple of months. My parents were due to arrive in Glasgow in July or August. But they didn't arrive until well into August. By that time, I was getting very desperate because the situation between Germany and Poland became more tense with every day. And I didn't know how much people in Germany knew about it. My father and mother stayed in a very nice hotel in Munich before they left, and they were going to spend the last penny, because they couldn't take it out in any case. So I kept on sending them telegrams that they should come. So eventually they did come. It was, I think, still 3 weeks before the war against Poland broke out. I understood from Glasgow Jewish people that the factors, it was in those days, factors who let the flats from the property owners, factors, a lot of them, particularly the one where I rented that flat, were not known to be very favorable towards Jewish tenants. But I was told afterwards I got that flat because it was in such a terrible condition that nobody else would take it, as I soon found out. I moved into the flat about a week before a fortnight before my parents arrived. And every night that flat was alive with cockroaches, with mice, with rats. Anything that could move on the floor must have been hidden in that flat. So I spent the next couple of weeks putting down rat poison, mice poison, killing cockroaches. I would get up 3-4 times a night with some instrument in my hand, kill as many as I saw crawling across the floor. So, and put powder down. Even because I knew if my mother came and moved into a flat like that, she would be very, very unhappy. So I managed to get rid of all the livestock. Right. And I also went and wallpapered 2 of the rooms, or 3 of the rooms, the kitchen and 2 of the rooms, I think, wallpapered at the weekends before my parents arrived. I think I even made a reasonably good job. So when my parents arrived, the flood wasn't too bad. They arrived, first I and then my parents both had a lift van, which was a big container where one could take out one's belongings, furniture, bedding, cutlery, crockery, and so on. So we had a reasonably well-furnished flat once all that stuff had arrived. Well, right, I continued working there in the Universal Covers. The war broke out in late August or early September 1939, and it was not until June 1940, after the military debacle in France, that the British government interned the Nazi refugees. My father, as he had no job, was taken in first together with a lot of older people, and he was taken to the Isle of Man. I was arrested with a lot of younger people, collected by the police with a lot of younger people who were all in work, and I was, our group was not taken to the Isle of Man. We were first kept for 3 days. We were in the Maryhill police station. Then we were taken to the Donaldson School camp in Edinburgh, which was a school for the deaf, which had before the war been a school for the deaf and dumb. From there we were taken to an internment camp in Argyll, which before the war had been a forester's camp, Glenbrander camp. In Glen Brander Camp, yes, in Glen Brander Camp, we must have stayed about 2 months. Well, the scenery, of course, was beautiful. Real Argyle Shires scenery, mountains. And then from there later on, we were moved to another Scottish forester's camp near Napdale Camp on near Dunoon. I stated that I had an emigration waiting number to go to the United States. And so eventually I was moved from Napdale Camp to the Lingfield Racecourse, which was also used as an internment camp for those who were eventually going to America. Because with the bombing of London, the American consul had moved his office, the consulate, from London to Derby. And Lingfield was very close to Derby, so if one had to go and see the consul, it wasn't far to go. But I didn't want to go to America. I felt this was the war was on against Hitler and the Nazis. America was at that time not at war, and I felt my place was here in this country and to help with winning the war. So I decided not to make use of any possibility I would have to go to America. While I was in the camp, I volunteered as an air raid warden, and this camp was bombed. The camp wasn't bombed, but the Lingfield Racecourse, on the one side was the terracing for the people who were watching races in peacetime. On the other side, there was a little copse, small piece of wood, and a Canadian tank battalion, tank regiment, I don't know where, in that wood with their tanks. So the Germans must have known it, so they were trying to bomb that Canadian tank unit almost every night. They never hit us, and they never hit the Canadian tank regiment. But a lot of the bombs came down in the middle, of the race course. So we had air raid patrols, and I volunteered because I felt I would rather be out and see what's happening rather than sitting up in the terraces and wait till something comes down through the roof. So it was quite an interesting time, especially as during that time we were near the Epsom Downs, and every day above the camp we saw the Battle of Britain took place, and we saw the German planes coming, we saw the RAF flying up, and saw the dogfights, and we always applauded whenever we saw a German bomber or fighter coming down in flames. So it was a most interesting time, really, to be an eyewitness to the Battle of Britain. I mean, we had people there from every walk of life. We had university professors, you had lecturers, and you could go to lectures every day, morning, noon, and night. And it was like being on a university campus. I mean, one really could enlarge one's knowledge. I mean, we were never bored. The thing was, it was difficult to get news from home, because all letters, all correspondence between the outside world and the internees went on Red Cross messages. And all the mail had to go through the centre in Liverpool. And Liverpool was being bombed every night. So sometimes we would get mail which was 3 and 4 weeks old, which was a bit disconcerting. I didn't know, because you heard Glasgow was being bombed as well. They couldn't say much. They said, we're all right. All right, and there wasn't much. Well, my mother could tell me. She wasn't doing an awful lot. My father was away. She would say, well, I've had a letter from Dad, and he's all right. And Dad would get a letter saying, Martin is all right. So eventually I was released from internment, I think in October 1940, as a young man, because I volunteered to go for war work. That was one of the, everybody tried to get out under a different, for a different reason. I would like to say here and now that I do not in any way blame the British government for interning us. Right enough, we were refugees from Nazi oppression, but we were also frightened people. At that time, after what happened in France and at Dunkirk, the British soldiers came home. They came home without weapons. Britain faced an enemy who was armed to the teeth. They could expect an invasion any day. And I know from myself, if I had been in Glasgow and I had been told or heard that German troops had landed anywhere on the Scottish coast, I would have packed a bag and left and went up to the Highlands, and so would my parents have done, of course. And it takes only two or three people in one street to panic, and then the whole street panics. And we refugees, with our experience of Nazi concentration camps, we would have run to the other side of the country to get away from the invasion area as far as possible. That would have caused panic amongst the civilian population. It would have obstructed the roads at a time when the British Army would have needed the roads to move troops and material from one side to the other. Also, I would say that there were probably between 50 and 60,000 German, Czech and Polish refugees in Great Britain. It would not have been beyond Hitler's ingenuity to plant amongst those people a number of spies under the guise of being a refugee. And even if they had only found 10 amongst us, it was worthwhile interning us all. Because all we wanted and were after was that Great Britain should not collapse under the Nazi onslaught, and that Great Britain should win the war against Hitler. And whatever sacrifices we refugees had to make in the process were of no importance whatsoever to the progress of history and to the fate of what the world would have experienced if Hitler had crossed the Channel. Right. I came back from internment. My father came back from internment a couple of months later. I took on a by that time, I wasn't confined with my job, with jobs anymore. I could move from one job to the other. I took on a similar job as I had done in the Universal Covers with a non-Jewish firm in Maryhill, McClelland's, and I worked there for a while. And then the government came out with the government training scheme, training people to be engineers, engine fitters, and so on. And a friend of mine, Adi Bester, who later on emigrated with his family to New Zealand, he and I went together to the government training center in Thornley Bank, and we were trained there as engine fitters. I went to a government training center. I enjoyed it very much. I always had an engineering bent, and it was great. My technical drawings were so good there that our technical instructor showed them around the whole of the shift, showing them how nicely technical drawings can be done. So we were there for about 6 or 8 months. The course lasted 6 or 8 months. But we found difficulties in getting a job, because obviously all factories were on war work, and taking in somebody who was a German refugee didn't appeal to everybody who was on war work. I remember that Adolf Bester and I once went to a factory who was making, in Glasgow, who were making tanks, Scotland Street, I've forgotten their name, and we would have been dead keen in building tanks to shoot at the Nazis. But the man said, no, I'm sorry, I don't know whether I would get away with it, but I don't want any Germans. I could understand it. So would we perhaps have been. Eventually, my friend Adolf Bester got a job at King Aircraft in Hillington as a mechanic, or instrument mechanic. In fact, he moved up later on to be their factory inspector there. And I went, eventually managed to get a job in Newton Mearns in a firm, Atco Motor Moors. This was a firm who built motor moors during the war. No, it were motor moors in peacetime who had branch service units all over the country. They had about 10 or 12 branches all over Scotland, all over the UK. They had one in Glasgow, which was the Scottish one. And after the outbreak of war, the Ministry of Supply had taken on this firm, and they were then working as army auxiliary workshops, repairing army motorcycles. I got there. The boss was an extremely nice man, and Mr. Sorry, maybe I get the name later on. He was extremely nice. He said to me, "Well, Martin, you're a German refugee. Never mind. I'm sure you're all right." So, at that time in 1941, the supply of spare parts for army motorcycles was still not all that well organized. And my first job in there was dismantling motorcycles into the different parts, keep all the parts which were good and usable as a second-hand store and supplying them upstairs for the motorcycles which were repaired. They realized from my commercial experience, my technical experience, that I could do better than being downstairs in that little dump. So they took me upstairs and put me in charge of the spare parts department, and I was the link man between our resident Ministry of Supply workshop officer and the firm. We would plan between us. We would get motorcycles in from army units which needed repair, and I would have a note of which machines which make was in. I would have to get ready, see that the necessary spare parts of that particular make were coming in, assessing what I assumed might be required. And during all that time, a lot of our motorcycles which we repaired, some of them went back to their own units, others went straight to convoys which were going overseas. I know we repaired all the motorcycles which were used in the invasion of North Africa in the so-called armored mail division. Their regimental sign was a mailed fist. That we did all the motorcycles for that unit. So while I was there till the end of the war, something like probably 3,000 motorcycles went through our hands, and we never missed a convoy. In fact, Minister of Ply workshop of officer was one of the people who signed my naturalization application at the end of the war. I got on extremely well with my Scottish colleagues who were the mechanics and so on. And during all the time when there was German bombing of Glasgow or the Clyde, nobody ever came and said, that was your friends who were over here last night. They were very, very fair, and I must speak in the highest terms of them. So by the end of the war, the firm and Atco Motor Moors relinquished their army contract. I would have liked to stay with them after the war and go into engineering, go into their head office in Birmingham. I would have liked to have gone down to the Birmingham office as to be the head in charge of the head stores, but they told me that they couldn't do it because A, returning soldiers would be entitled to get their jobs back. Secondly, they said, Martin, you're not a time-served or trained engineer. We would have trouble with the trade unions. But they made a very fair agreement with me. They said, Martin, we know that you want to leave. You know our situation. You can stay. If you stay with us till we have wound up our contract with the Ministry of Supply, because if the mistake had been made, it would have cost them a lot of money. They would have had to pay for the spares. If you stay with us till the Ministry of Supply contract is finished, we keep you on until you've found something which you want to do.